You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I've heard stories of girls who grow up happy and well-adjusted, with a healthy relationship to food and their bodies. Screw those bitches.
Hello, and welcome to another Slate spoiler special. I'm Slate podcast producer Daniel Schrader, and today we're spoiling Insatiable, the much-maligned Netflix series starring Debbie Ryan and Dallas Roberts. Here to talk with me about the show is senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts, June Thomas. Hey, June.
Hey, Daniel.
And Vox Culture staff writer Constance Grady. Hey, Constance.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Of course. Thanks for coming on. So I guess we should dive in. Let's talk about Insatiable. First, I guess we should get first impressions. What did we think of the show? How did it go down or not the first time you watched it? Constance?
All right. Well, this is going to be interesting because we've kind of flipped the balance of power, right? Like, I think Insatiable has, what, an 11 or 12% on Rotten Tomatoes right now, but in this room...
Oh, it had 10, but then it has 11 now that I've
reviewed
it.
Because of you.
Yes.
You single-handedly saved it. So you two both like the show, and I'm more on the not-a-fan end of the spectrum, so we're a little bit switching around the conversation. I guess for me, the main thing with Insatiable is that it's about this fantasy of... what if someone hurt me so badly I couldn't eat anymore and then my body became perfect, right? Which we see play out with the main character, Patty, who's a fat girl who her classmates call Fatty Patty, who gets into a fight with a homeless man when he tries to steal her chocolate bar. He hits her. She gets her jaw wired shut for 3 months. She can't eat. She's on a liquid diet. And then she becomes incredibly beautiful. And the rest of the show is her, like, trying to wreak her revenge on her classmates by going into beauty pageanting. So I think a lot of the disagreement about this show comes down to, do you think the show is subverting this fantasy, or is it sort of leaning into it in an uncomfortable way? I think the position of the show is definitely that it's subverting the fantasy, right? Because Patty, once she becomes skinny, doesn't become a good person. She's been psychologically warped by these years of bullying. She's mean, and she wants revenge, and she low-key maybe murders a couple of people.
At least.
So for me, what keeps the subversion of the fantasy from totally landing is that I don't think the worst-case scenario for this show is Patty never fills the hole that is inside of her. She never finds a way to become healthy and a complete person. I think the show finds Patty's damage kind of sexy and fun. And as the audience, we are supposed to, too. I think that's why, like, the title card always lands on Patty, on, like, the pair of lips licking.
Ugh, I love it. It's delicious.
I think that part of the show is supposed to be really, really fun and glamorous. I think what's actually the worst case scenario on this show is Patty becomes fat again. I think that it consistently links her fatness to a kind of patheticness. And the value structure that sets in place is part of why the show feels so gross and uncomfortable to me as a viewer. The other question, of course, with the show is it funny? And that's sort of a hard thing to talk about because, like, either you laugh or you didn't. Mm. And I mostly did not laugh. I think that
you monster.
I think that it's constantly going for an aesthetic mode of, like, too muchness. Like, that's where the humor is. Just all of these details piling on top of
each
other. Yeah,
the pageant is named Miss Magic Jesus,
exactly.
Where they do, like, a song about asking Jesus to get inside of them.
I mean, first of all, not a super new joke. Like,
well, no, but, like, I don't know. As a guy from Georgia,
sure.
I like. Lived that world, and so, like, being in the number of church musicals that I was in, like, that hit home for me, and like, this could happen.
I mean, for me, I saw that joke better executed in Sister Act the musical on Broadway, and I feel like that's not the bar Netflix show should be aiming for.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in general, the mode is the show moves so slowly and it doesn't have the energy that I would want to keep those jokes from sort of cascading in a froth the way I think that the show is aiming for. And I think often the button of the humor punches down in a kind of weird, uncomfortable way. Like there's a long, long running gag about Patty's best friend, Nani, who is a closeted lesbian and has a crush on Patty. And for basically the first half of the season, the joke is just Nani's gay for Patty. That's hilarious somehow.
See, but OK, so I'm kind of in the middle. I enjoyed the show. I think there are certain things that there are certain characters, Christian, who, you know, if
the
I could.
Thank God she killed him.
Right. That was my favorite scene.
The best part. As she's yelling, I'm a good person. Right. I'm a good person. Like,
I felt that.
I would have liked to consign him to a flaming pit a lot earlier. And so, you know, and I felt like it was kind of there is a lot too much in this show. However, I did not have the complaints that you're expressing very well, Constance. For example, speaking about Nani, for me, you can see that there is a sense that some people might find it funny. But I don't think the show ever wants us to find Nani's obvious love for Patty sad or pathetic. I think that it's presented as something that's, you know, loyalty, which in many ways I think is the value that the show really emphasizes. Nani loves Patty. Nani might be a lesbian and she's not sure. She's figuring it out. She's denying it at first, but eventually she finds a girlfriend. She does come out a little bit magically in many ways. But to me, I don't see that punching down. And I guess throughout, I see characters who in other shows might have been presented as sad and pathetic. I see them as like the heroes of the show. Donald Choi, Nani,
Dallas Roberts.
Yeah.
Like, we haven't even talked about him yet.
No question, I think Dallas Roberts' character, Bob, is the favorite of the show. Like, it loves him.
Mm-hmm. So this, for me, it hit home for me in another way as, like, a young gay person who knew he was gay but hadn't come out yet. And the, like, uncomfortable, weird relationships I had with other boys my age where, like, I was clearly obsessed with them, but I didn't know how to process that and admit that. And seeing that on screen is like, oh, I went through that. Oh, I was so obsessed with this person that I like did some inappropriate things as a younger person. And like seeing that depicted was just like, oh, you see my experience kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of like what's great about this show a lot of the time for me, at least, was that I saw a lot of my experience in it, whether it's like being a fat person or being a gay person or being an effeminate person. I kept seeing myself in these characters, and that's why I loved them so much, because they were heightened versions of everything I was. And that's one of the reasons I glommed onto it so well. But we should talk about Dallas Roberts, because he's the star of the show, I think. I mean, I love Debbie Ryan. I love everybody else in the cast. Alyssa Milano is great. Chris Gorham, oh my God, he's beautiful. Like, everyone is good in this show.
Yeah.
But he is a star.
Except, well, and I agree that he is a star, and it's about time that he got to be the star of a show.
I didn't even know who he was before this. And like, I've run in, like you said it, Isaac Butler said it, a couple of other people like online said, I'm just glad Dallas Roberts is getting more work. And I'm like, who is this guy?
Right. Oh, but the reason I interrupted you is because I think that again, not in the most subtle way, because no one could accuse this show of subtlety, but that Bob Armstrong, because something that's typical of the show, we have two characters named Bob, very key characters. But anyway, Bob Armstrong and Patty Bladel are very much paired. Like, they have many of the same issues, many of the same causes. They are each other's saviors and each other's, best
devils
hope.
On the shoulder as
right,
well.
Right, exactly. But they're not the same person, of course, but they have a ton in common. So I think if Bob is the hero, in a sense, that means that Patty, too, is a hero, because they're paralleled so clearly.
Well, to me, I think what distinguishes their arcs is that there's so much love and affection in the portrayal of Bob, and especially in his coming out story at the end of the show, when he begins to embrace his bisexuality and explore the possibility of a polyamorous relationship, which is really beautifully done. And
yep.
It's so rare on television.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to see the same affection extended towards Patty, especially when she is fat. One of the quotes about the show that I thought was really beautifully stated was from Linda Holmes at NPR. She says, if what you want to demonstrate is in a story is that someone deserves love in a particular state of being, you must show them being loved in that state. And if you, the storyteller, can't quite bring yourself to show it, you probably don't quite believe it. I think we see Bob being loved as who he is, and that's so moving. I don't think we get to see Patty being loved unless she is skinny and looking like Debbie Ryan.
I see. I do think we get it from Nonny. Mm-hmm. And I think that she doesn't get it from assholes like her mom, who is not exactly an asshole, but who is very troubled.
She's selfish.
She's selfish, like as pretty much everybody in the show is. And she's an alcoholic. She's not in control of herself, in a sense. She does love Patty, but she can't show it in any way at all. Nonny, I think, is the only person who loves Patty unquestioningly. But I think this is where we're getting into the central question of the show, which is, I kind of agree with Linda that maybe it is a flaw of the show that we don't ever see Patty, other than from Nonny, getting any affection when she was fat. We see only the torture that she endured. But I also think that anytime you put someone in a fat suit, like, it's basically impossible to make them a real person. And mm-hmm. I think anytime you have a fat suit in a show, it's a big, I don't know if it's a big mistake, because clearly people see it as a necessity to show, like, to have flashbacks to show what she went through. But yeah, it's, you can never have a fully realized person
right.
in that suit.
Mm-hmm. And one of my issues with that review and a couple of people online about this is that, like, this show isn't about fat happiness. It's not about finding happiness regardless of your size. It's about realizing that you can be skinny and you can still be a monster. Like, it doesn't, that doesn't fix it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so here's my question about that argument is, I feel like it is possible to make a show about a fat person who is desperately unhappy with themselves and who is treated terribly by the world around them, and not, like, reflect the self-hatred of that fat character back out at the audience. Insatiable, I felt like, kept pushing me to kind of despise Patty in that fat suit a little bit. I think partially just because it is a fat suit and it looked so lumpy and fake, and the cheek padding was so, like, over the top and grotesque, and poor Debbie Ryan looked very uncomfortable trying to move in it because her center of gravity was off. I think just the use of that prop is in its way dehumanizing and keeps pushing the audience to just constantly hate her when she's fat a little bit.
But see, I never felt that.
I never hated her when she was fat. I felt sorry for her because I saw myself in her. I was like, I've been that fat kid. I've been made fun of as a child for being a, like, fat queer kid. And so, I don't know. I never like hated her. I hated her when she was skinny. I hated her. And I loved that. Because when I hated her, I then was forced to reckon with, oh, wait, but I've also had these feelings. Like, I've had these motivations of wanting to, like, not kill someone necessarily, but, like, ruin their lives or something like that. I've had that rage. I've had that sorrow of having to eat an entire sheet cake by myself. Those types of things.
I just want to mention, one of the things that I think is important is, ultimately, I think the disagreement over the show is how much faith you assign to the creators, of how, like, both good faith, like, were they trying to do something decent or were they just piling on and being mean? But, or how much they had a story that they wanted to tell, how much they had just meaning that they wanted to, a takeaway they wanted to give viewers. And for me, I feel like they did. I feel like they were saying that don't get hung up on appearances, like, over and over throughout the show, not just physical appearances, although clearly, you know, given the story of Patty, that's one that we really grab onto. But all of the characters almost had some moment where they were, where they chose to go with what they felt the appearance, you know, what their appearance should be. And it was always something that ultimately made them sort of sad inside.
Like the Coralie, played by Alyssa Milano, and Patty scene, where they are in a mother-daughter beauty pageant together, even though they're not related, which Like, of course, sure. Right. And they do a great scene where they topiary, like hedge trimming or whatever. And at the end, Patty is so excited that like they won and wants to celebrate with Coralie. And Coralie just dismisses her as like, oh, no, sweetie, we're done now.
Right.
Like,
because her junior league
friends. I've used you.
Yeah. Her junior league friends are there. And what she really wants is not to be. To have happiness and fulfillment, but to, you know, get in with the junior league women. But the other thing I would also say is that, just to get back to Patty, is that she's 18, you know, she's 17 when we meet her. She is a kid and she is still so partly unformed, but and also having had terrible parenting, but also...
Well, and every adult in the show is horrible.
Yeah, everybody in the show is horrible. And I think that... Patty is, she's first of all so very close to the pain and the torture that she endured, but also she's a kid, and so when she lashes out, she's not able to kind of, you know, reel it back in because she, you know, she's 17 years old.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I thought it was the worst moment of my life, but looking back, it was one of the best because it brought me to the man who put me on the path to becoming the most famous beauty queen in the country.
Hey, you got $5? How about that candy bar? It's not like you need it, fatty.
What can I say? This story is full of some crazy.
So let's get back to what happened. So we start with Patty getting punched in the face and her jaw getting broken. She loses a bunch of weight. And she is at a hearing, and Dallas Roberts, who plays Bob Armstrong, is there to be her defense attorney and ends up getting her off because she twists things around on Chris Gorham's character, Bob Barnard, where she basically says, yeah, maybe I did it, but also, like, you're fat shaming me. And is that something that you want to do? And it was kind of a, like, gleeful wink at itself. Granted, the first episode is not good, right. Just like the last episode is not good. But
stipulated.
There are just moments like that where it turns the expectation on itself, and that's what, like, fills me with a, like, camp glee. And that's I sent you my piece about it. Like, that's what I feel about the show, is the show is just camp, and I get to live in the inconsistent messiness of it. And so, like, after she and Bob team up, then he's like, you should be a beauty queen and I can get you there. And then we go on the journey of Patty becoming a beauty queen and what she has to do and Bob helping her get there.
So her plot at first is to seduce the homeless guy who punched her and then murder him. Thus, I guess.
Well, I think the plot was at first is just to have sex with him and that's her revenge.
Right. And then she moves from there to the idea of burning him alive. And she thinks she doesn't do it, but she also goes into a fugue state and maybe does it. And then she goes and visits him at the hospital where he's been.
Well, she and Nani and our friend Donald Choi get together and try to recreate the night. So they get her super drunk, and she's so drunk that she has to get her stomach pumped. And that's why she's at the hospital.
Which, by the way, was very American Vandal. And I kind of feel like if you're going to come for the king there, like, got to step up your game a little.
Well, and a missed opportunity for cross promotion because they plug Santa Clarita Diet.
Exactly.
Endlessly. I feel like Drew Barrymore was like had a part in line in her contract.
Oh, yes.
So now the alcohol poisoned Patty ends up at the hospital. Homeless guy is also there. He's been badly burned. He accuses her of being the one who burned his hotel room. And then Bob has to sort of come to her rescue and pull this fantastic, like, courtroom drama monologue explaining how it couldn't possibly have been Patty. And that it's the weirdest scene because it's played very ambiguously, but Patty maybe just, like, wills him to death with her mind?
And I have to say, this is one area where I have no patience for the show. Toward the end of this first season, especially, the show develops what I guess we could call a supernatural plot line in terms of, like, does she have a demon?
Yeah, there's an exorcism, which I will say, I think that that is a bad storyline and absurd. But to me, whenever you see supernatural stuff in a TV show, it signals to me this is a queer show. And that's why I'm always here for it. Like, that's why I prefer Teen Wolf to Riverdale any day of the week. So
I'm very with you on that.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad we can agree on something.
But that is our first indication, and it's one that I rue, that perhaps she does have some kind of power. But also, this is. But we also have been informed that the homeless guy has been a terrible alcoholic and has.
And he was going to AA and was still drinking.
Yeah, and has a weak liver and a weak heart and has, you know, essentially destroyed his innards. So although there's a possibility that Patty is exerting some influence, there's also a good chance that it's merely life itself that is playing out.
Yeah, and I mean, for all that scene is absurd, it's. To me, it is all worth it for the smirk that Debbie Ryan gets on her face when she realizes, if I can do this, what else can I do?
And I think that definitely one of the bright spots of this show is Debbie Ryan's performance and just, like, the glee that she takes in all of the terrible, terrible things she does.
Yeah, who knew? She's a star.
Yeah. But I do think that there is, like, for a show like this, which, you know, in 12 episodes, 12, 40, 45, sometimes 50-minute episodes, you know, which, like many shows these days, burns through plot like, you know, some kind of supernova. Still, the actors really do perform incredibly well. I can't think of any poor performances from any of the leads. I mean, they don't all have good things to do. Like, Christian really is a terrible role, but even that actor, like, does okay.
Oh,
with
yeah.
It.
Well, he knows.
He's there to smolder. He smolders. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. To me, they all know the show they're in.
Yeah.
Like, they all know what they're doing, and what they're doing is too much.
Yeah. Well, so I guess the first challenge that Patty, now completely and fully committed to becoming a beauty pageant queen, meets is that the Miss Magic Jesus pageant is coming up very soon, and she hasn't yet qualified, and so.
Well, so at first they go to Miss
Bareback Buckaroo.
Yes.
So that Patty can get some sense of the world of pageants. And also so that we can get a little bit of Bob Armstrong's backstory with
Stella Rose.
With Stella Rose, played by the amazing Beverly D'Angelo, who I'd never seen Debbie Ryan before, but as soon as I saw and heard her, I thought, oh, wow, she's a young Beverly D'Angelo, in the sense that she has this amazing voice that you think, wow, is she a 70-year-old who's like Benjamin Buttoned? Because her voice is very lived in and very, very lovely. But anyway, so we learn that Stella Rose and Bob have both romantic history and opportunities and motivations to kind of, I don't know, double cross each other.
We meet Stella Rose and her protege Roxy, mm-hmm. who we then come to find out might be Bob Armstrong's love child. And then it turns out, no, it's not she's not Bob Armstrong's love child with Stella Rose. She's Bob Barnard's love child with Stella Rose. And we think that, like, oh, well, he slept with Stella Rose to get back at Bob Armstrong. But, like, that plays out differently, which we will get to. But there's still more going on.
So when we first met Bob Armstrong, he actually had just lost, or his mentee had just lost a pageant by being useless at the...
You mean ISIS? Like Italian ISIS?
I love him.
Should I just do the rest of this show in an accent?
Since you are from Georgia, that would be appropriate.
Okay. Sure thing.
So Dixie Sinclair, who, you know, is the appearance part of the pageant, failed the knowledge and charm part by giving a dumb answer to one of the interview questions. And because her mother, Regina Sinclair, was so mad at Bob, she falsely accused him of touching Dixie's hoo-ha. Now, some critics, Constance, you may be one, have pointed, you know, that yes, if this was a show that was being performed in earnest, this would be an absolutely terrible thing. But even then, it was clear to me that there's no suggestion that this is not the real world. In other parts of the show, I mean, clearly this does become something of a problem, because later when the show attempts to make serious points, the fact that he has lost all contact with earnestness causes a problem, because we are, for me, untethered from reality. So whereas if in a show, say if Jane the Virgin, which actually I think works in some similar territory in the sense of they burn through plot, it's essentially a soap opera like this show is, but they're very earnest. If they had tried to do something like that, it would have been awful. It would have been completely out of tone. It would have been like, oh my God, this, you know, I would be up in arms. I'd be, you know, writing offended columns. But because it is, even at that point, so untethered from reality, to me, there's no issue with the fact that, you know, this Regina is a crazy person. And she is using the tools at her disposal, which are, you know, baseless accusations, to get back at Bob. But Bob, as an accused sex offender, can't get any work. And so,
his entire reputation
yeah,
is now ruined.
His reputation is in shatter,
yes. And
so
that's why he comes to Patty.
Right.
And realize they have to work together.
Yeah.
And so this is actually one of the things that keeps that joke from landing for me is the sort of the punchline of the joke is RPC culture is going too far and just believing this baseless accusation. Can you even believe it? We need to like take some time and really delve into due process, which, you know, as we all know, is not the case. And in fact, statistically, we're very, very bad at taking these accusations seriously and are much more likely to dismiss them out of hand. And while I take your point that the tone of the show is such that it wants you to be like, oh, don't take this seriously, I think if you're going to engage with a joke like that and in fact make it an impetus for the plot, you do have a responsibility to take it kind of not seriously, but to at least engage with the issues in good faith.
Well, but in a sense they do, because we, again, if we're going to take it seriously, if we're not going to like, oh, we're in fantasy land, the fact that Bob is, although he doesn't, people aren't coming to him for legal advice, and even though some people are kind of avoiding him on the street, he's still part of the community. He's not actually being treated like a sex offender. He's not actually, going through he's not going through any of the terrible travails that sex offenders, whether falsely accused or correctly accused, endure in our system. So, and then Regina, who has made this false accusation, which is clear to us is false, us as viewers, is clearly a person who has no morals, who has...
Well, and so she gets arrested. She is actually sleeping with Bob's son, Brick, who is smoking hot. And she, like, actually gets arrested for sleeping with an underage boy. And so, like, that, in that way, they do address, like, when it actually happens, justice works. And I think, for me at least, one of the things I love about this show is that, like, that's how it works. Like, when something like that happens, oh, of course, she's going to get arrested because, like, that is illegal. And that's what happens. And so, like, when we're not expecting that to play out as some, like, part of the plot that's this big dramatic thing. No, like, when she gets in jail, things happen. But that kind of thing is just expected. There are so many, like, social debates that I feel like this show doesn't need to have because it's already decided that they're resolved. Like, oh, if someone is guilty of this, they just go to jail. If someone is gay, they're not going to get made fun of for being gay. Like, those types of things. Like, this world is just progressive, maybe too much.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it does continually go back to the idea of false accusations of sexual assault being like an easy way out of something, right? That's part of how Patty gets out of having punched the homeless guy. She suggests that he tried to touch her inappropriately. And the way it's played is not like, oh, that's like a really terrible thing to do. Although it sort of is, because it's Patty and everything she does is kind of terrible. But the joke of the moment is like, oh, well, they can't argue with that because if they do, they'll be slut shaming her.
See, but I think that's, at least to me, that's a misreading of the scene because, and this is like that scene. And I feel like the first scene when she punches the homeless guy have been misread a lot by critics because like the first scene when she gets punched by a homeless guy, she's not punching him because he's trying to eat her candy bar. She's punching him because he called her a fatty. And like that is a trigger for her. And then in the scene when she is like saying, oh, well, he tried to touch me, Chris Gorham, Bob Barnard is like, well, no, here's the quote that you said like in the report about like no one's going to take my food or something like that.
And he even says it in that weird way.
He says it like this, like, yeah. No one takes fatty's food or something like
right,
that.
Right.
And like, that is what he's accusing her of. Yes, she tries to use the excuse of, like, oh, he was going to touch me. And he's like, no, that's not what you said.
But I think the way that it plays, you see, like, the reactions from people in the courtroom, and they're very like, oh, this perfect little delicate angelic white girl was going to be molested against her will. There's, like, the what she's harnessing is the desire to protect the sexuality of white women, right?
Well, I'm not sure. I didn't read it that particular way, because it's interesting to me that they don't bring the homeless guy into the courtroom for various reasons. And so I'm not sure that we're, you know, there's, to me, there's this aspect of the show where one of the parallels between Bob and Patty is that he, as an attorney, understands the importance of appearances. And, you know, in a way that there's this really direct connection between his life as a pageant coach and his unmistakable skills in that arena, and his understanding that the criminal justice system has this ridiculous streak where, like, if you look the right way, you get an unfair advantage. And he has been playing that for many years.
Yeah.
And so
The courtroom is a pageant.
And so for me, that, yes, there's an element of she's taking advantage of something that is unfair. But I'm not sure that I didn't see it as in the way that you did. Instead, it's like, yeah, this is really unfair, but she's working it. She also, in fact, does something that I consider much worse, where she just completely perverts the course of justice when she attempts to kind of wink and nudge her way to get Donald Choi to, essentially perjure himself. And that, to me, is so much worse, and is really just about her kind of figuring out the power, as she sees it, of her new body. And that I really can't in any way justify. But I don't see what the thing that happens with the Bobs in the way that you described it.
Shirtless Bob.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Hot Bob.
Hot Bob. And other Bob.
Other Bob. All right. So let's get back to the plot, I guess.
So Carly wants to get into the Junior League. So she gets in touch with Etime Barnard, Bob's wife, who is an amazingly successful physician, always flying around the country, separating conjoined twins. She's hardly ever at home, but she is the leader of the Junior League, the leader of the
PTA,
something to do with the church fellowship. She's the person to get to know. So in an attempt to win her over and to regain, or to gain perhaps for the first time, her position in this town's society, Coralie, Bob Armstrong's wife, is essentially trying to seduce Etime Barnard, Bob Barnard's wife. And she does this by starting a group for working women.
That's where we get the pageant that Patty has to compete in,
right,
to then qualify for Miss Magic Jesus. And so they have this mother-daughter pageant idea, but then, wait, Patty doesn't have a mom that is reliable because her mom is an alcoholic.
Who's always disappearing to even now she's
in
recovery.
On the first day of school, she leaves.
Right.
She's like, I'll be back in a week so that I can take care of you better by, like, taking care of myself.
Patty does indeed do the pageant with Coralie. Mm-hmm. But then Patty's mom, Angie, decides she too does want to do the pageant, maybe just to get back at Patty. It's not really clear what her motivation is. So she does the pageant with Nani, Patty's best friend, and who has a crush on her, whose mom is dead. There's something very, actually quite touching about this. You know, Coralie and Patty realize they have a lot in common, both in terms of their backgrounds, their parenting styles. And Nani and Angie also kind of bond. In a way, it's like, again, it's like something that is not necessarily the great story, because what we realize is they don't really want Patty to get better, because they enjoyed their relationship with, mm-hmm, with kind of tortured Patty, with, you know, pained Patty, because they had her to themselves in a way. When Patty has more of a life, she doesn't have as much time for Nani.
Yeah, Donald Choi even says to Nani, like, you're acting like you're jealous. She's not your friend. You're obsessed with her.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they, you know, I don't know if Nani and Angie realize this, but we realize that there are often kind of bad motivations or bad responses to Patty's, you know, having lost this weight. That this, you know, in many ways for me, the show is kind of a quest to integrate mm-hmm. both yourself and how and other people's change into your relationships with them. And that's a place where we really see very clearly that even nice people, which I think Nani definitely is a nice person, often have not nice motivations.
The way that that episode ends is Coralie is very dismissive of Patty. So then Patty blows up her life by giving her a necklace that Stella Rose received from Bob that basically shows that they had an affair while Coralie and Bob were married. And so that blows up their life. Bob gets angry. Patty is angry. Everybody's upset. We move on to the next episode, Bikinis and Bitches. It's the dog car wash. I mean, not dog car wash. What am I saying? It's the bikini
dog washing.
The bikini dog wash, yes.
Which is somebody who's watched lots of high school TV shows but never went to American high school. I have to tell you that I have the impression that American high school is one long car wash.
Mm-hmm. And no, so, you're not like, wrong. Yeah.
To me, that was like,
we need a fundraise. Let's wash things.
Exactly. Exactly.
Just the only thing that, on the parade.
The only thing that happens more often in American high school than bikini car washes are like famous bands coming and playing the prom.
Yes, exactly.
Also that.
Wish we had a prom in this.
Yeah. Next time.
Yeah. So, yeah, fingers crossed for season two. and sorry. So, they're like, a car wash is played out, a dog wash is played out. How about, like, wait, sorry, a dog adoption is played out? I don't remember exactly.
I think it was bikini car wash is played out, dog wash is played out, let's do a bikini dog wash.
Yes, that's what it is. Great. So then they're like, bikini dog wash, let's do it. So they show up, everybody's there. This also is the episode where we get my favorite joke personally, which is Brick volunteering at the LGBTQ center, and he's painting over the word gay, like, inside the center. And one of the people at the center is like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm just painting over the, I was told to paint over the slurs. And he's just painting over this, like, wall that has, like, gay, queer, lesbian, like, in, like, like bright, sunny font. And the woman is just like, no, sweetie, he meant outside. And then it cuts to, like swastikas and, like, the word faggot misspelled and all these types of things. It's like, that is so funny to me.
I think the show is very funny. This was a show that I, that amused me, and that it really never did offend me, even except maybe some of those dental things. But
oh, June and her
and my dental obsession.
Yes,
but
sensitive teeth topics.
Exactly. But I did find it very, very funny. Were there things that you enjoyed constantly?
Is there something you liked? Did we bring you here under false pretenses?
I think that the voiceover jokes are consistently pretty solid. I think my issue with the humor is that there's not enough of that. There's way too much Dixie. Oh, my God.
And that accent.
She's
I'm
their
sorry,
go-to like, comic relief character, and everything about her is so grating.
Mm-hmm. Like, I liked her at first. She definitely staled on me really quickly. I think, at least to me, they used her less and less by the end of the season.
Well,
there's definitely that shift that the tonal shift that comes halfway through where it gets less campy,
like when she stops
and more sincere.
Living with them.
Yeah. I am ready to accept that there are some issues with the show. And one of the things that is weird and I wish didn't happen, even though I understand that it's part of maybe the show's biggest kind of takeaway and the point that it most wants to underline, and highlight, is kind of absentees. Like, almost all of the pain, I think, ultimately, in everybody comes from absentee parents or absentee children or absentee friends or just absenteeism. And yet the show just removes people for long stretches. I mean, Etame Barnard just disappears. She goes off doctoring.
Yeah, she's gone for a while.
Coralie just disappears. I mean, again, she's mad at Bob, but she just disappears. We don't see where she goes when she's not in Bob's life.
Stella Rose and Roxy don't pop up until 11 and 12 after we saw them in like 3, 4, or 5.
Exactly. And there's just like a whole lot of that where I understand there's a lot of plot there, but I wish they had not chosen to absent people in quite so often, because to me, that makes, in some ways, I was glad, because when Christian wasn't there, I was happy.
You forget Bob has a dad, though.
Well, exactly. And I don't.
Oh, he does, doesn't
right.
he?
His dad has a heart attack. And
that's
like,
right.
Where did that plot go? What? Yeah. See?
Or like the PI, you remember, who takes the pictures?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Of
what
like
happened
Magno,
to him?
You know, he just disappears. Like,
honestly, there are parts of it where it felt like there was so much that they had maybe even like taped a lot more and then cut it down and then realized, oh, we've cut out like plots that we thought we had.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have the bikini dog wash, which gets saved by Brick in the LGBTQ center, and they end up having a crazy fun time. But also the entire time I was watching, I was like, these people who, they may be drag queens, some of them may be trans women, like, would certainly not be getting their makeup wet like this. Like, this is insane. But anyway, also...
And it's really too bad that we never learn any of their names.
No, of course not. And also Brick says, as he's, like, bringing them over, he's like, they've been tweeting about it on social media the whole time. So, like, it's getting big. Yeah. As if, like, these people just hanging out at the LGBTQ center are, like, big Twitter presences that are just drawing everyone in this, like, small town in Georgia to a... bikini dog wash.
Everyone knows queer people are great at Twitter. That's
it's true. Okay, so we have that, and then we get to the Dunkin' Donut episode, which is the baptism.
Oh.
She wins the pageant, and so she qualifies for Miss Magic Jesus, but it turns out she's never been baptized, and you have to be baptized to be Miss Magic Jesus because it's a Baptist, like, competition, it seems like, because that's at least the church that is hosting and everything. So she starts going through spiritual counseling along with Bob, who's like, oh, well, I guess I could be your godfather. And Bob only realizes he's being a bad dad to Brick when he is doing it to become a better godfather. And Brick's like, what the fuck, dad? Like, you're supposed to be my dad, and you're only realizing you're a bad dad because you're being a dad to someone else? You're awful. And so they, like, go through the baptism. Bob gets dunked. And then Patty gets dunked, and you think that she's having this epiphany because she's been dosed with, what was it, Molly?
Something.
I think she was dosed with Molly. Yeah. And she, like, she's, you think she's going to, like, have this moving religious experience. She's, like, talking about it, but then as she's underwater, she sees this donut, and this donut's like, hey there, girl. Hey, I'm the hole that'll never be filled. Be selfish. Don't give in to this, like, selflessness that this church leader, played by Michael Ian Black, wonderfully, regardless of how bad his decisions in real life are, just don't listen to him. Be selfish. And so as soon as she comes out, it's to me, the sexiest scene in the entire show, where she comes out soaking wet with that bikini under the white, like, see-through outfit. And she's just like, I'm here. I'm hot. I'm ready to, like, own everything. And she then immediately ditches Brick, goes to Christian, who's this, like, bad boy, who's the son of the minister, who, as a son of a minister myself, I get it. Not really. He's trash. And so she, like, goes to him, and they then hook up in the church playground, which is a very accurate depiction of a church playground, having been to many of them as a child. And as she is getting eaten out, someone videotapes her. And so then we move on to the next episode, which is Miss Magic Jesus. And this is where first we find out that someone has videotaped her and has sent the, like, video to the board. And she is getting, like, thrown out. Yeah, she's getting disqualified. And so then she's like, yeah, but I never actually, like, there was no P in the V. And so then she ends up getting qualified. And this is when we first meet Dee,
right,
who is Nani's love interest.
So Dee is supposed to be, I think, an answer to the question of whether this show is fatphobic, because she is fat and she is proud of it, and she's Black and she's a lesbian.
She's also a college student. I'm very unclear with the age limits because she says she goes to Emory.
Right.
I was at Emory, so
this is like your life story.
I feel like I wrote this or like I birthed it, but anyway.
So she is supposed to be like, hey, this show is not fatphobic because, look, here's a fat woman who's proud of being fat. But for me, she was like such a token. Like,
yeah.
She has no identity outside of her identity.
Yeah. And she's, I think, the first time, or at least the most heavy handed time, that we get the show's attempt at what it's quote unquote saying. Yeah. And I never like when a show says something. Because basically, she and Patty are sitting next to each other, and Patty's like, it's my turn. I deserve this boy now. Like, I've been fat for so long that now I'm skinny. I deserve this happiness. And Dee just looks at her and is basically like, just because you're pretty on the outside doesn't mean you're pretty on the inside. Like, you sound like a bitch.
I mean, in some ways, it's too bad, because in many ways, Dee is a character that you kind of love to see. On the other hand, she's far too on the nose. And also, as far as we know, at least, she's the only character of color who doesn't have a white parent. Dixie, she's adopted. Her mom is white.
Bob, Donald Choi.
Right. Donald Choi We at least know that his father is Korean, but hey. But yeah, so that's true.
So it does almost feel like the only reason we can't say that Dee is a character of color without a white parent is they did not bother to give her a backstory or parents or anything like that. She just exists as a walking talking point.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to argue with that because, yeah, that's kind of how they used her. And it's too bad because she does open up Nani, I think, in an interesting way. I mean, there's nothing intrinsic to Dee.
They're like, one of the best scenes for me was when they're in that bathroom and she's just, yeah. And Dee is just hitting on Nani, and Nani's wearing this shirt, the best shirt of the entire series, which is just a button down with a pocket that has eyebrows and eyes embroidered on it. Like, yes. That is queer culture.
Exactly.
So. And I think that storyline is one of the first signals we get about the shift in tone that's coming, because this is when Nani's sexuality stops being a joke and starts to be like an actual lived experience for her. Mm-hmm. Like, there's like a real genuine shift halfway through this show where suddenly it stops being pure camp and it starts to have a sort of sincerity and an emotional resonance.
No, and the important thing about that is I agree with that. And unfortunately, the tonal shifts are always odd if they, because it's hard to make them work. But then it half moves from camp to, you know, something tender and sweet, and half moves to this supernatural bullshit. So
yeah, so we should get into that.
Yes.
So after Miss Magic Jesus, she does not win Miss Magic Jesus.
Because Bob Bernard gave his daughter
Magnolia
the answers, which she surely didn't. She's never lost a pageant, and
no,
she didn't even need to win this one, so whatever.
Yeah, she wins this one because she... There's like a component that was added at the last minute that was like Bible trivia, which I would be awesome at. And yes.
Did you do a kind of Jeopardy? And when they were giving the answers,
you
came up with the questions?
Oh, yes.
What was the answer to Josh? One of the answers was Josh. I didn't know what that was.
Oh, I don't remember.
Yeah,
but I'm sure. No, Josh was an answer. Or like Joshua or something. So anyway, Bob Barnard gets the quiz answers for his daughter and gives them to her. And then she's also hopped up on like Coke at the same time,
right.
Or
she's
something
also
like that.
A drug and
Adderall
alcohol
or something.
Yeah, yeah, that yeah. Whole thing. And then yeah. We lose
and
Magnolia
she,
for a couple episodes because
yeah.
She like
right.
Goes to
right.
That's
rehab.
Another like
and her
absentee.
Motivation for this whole thing is the sort of love quadrangle with Brick and Christian, where she and Patty have kind of been trading them back and forth. And at this point, yeah. Patty mm-hmm. has both of them, and
right.
Magnolia is like not here for that.
Exactly. Yeah. So after Magnolia wins, then Bob Barnard realizes how much of a problem his daughter has. And so he's like, well, we need to get her disqualified. So he gives Bob Armstrong that like, hey, she had the quiz answers, which Magnolia overhears him revealing and then goes and ODs. And then she gets sent to rehab for a couple episodes. So she gets to be absentee for a while as well. So Patty loses. And then...
But she and Christian head out, light out for
oh,
the territory.
Right. So she and Christian run off. And so then Patty has the chance to be Miss Magic Jesus, but she has to come back from her, like, romp with Christian. And
her,
so...
Yeah, her cross-border fuckfest has to be
her
cross-border shortened.
Fuckfest,
yes.
Yes,
has to be foreshortened and she returns.
So now that Patty is the winner of Miss Magic Jesus, she now needs a sponsor for regionals. So she goes to the Wiener Taco, which we haven't even mentioned yet, and is the place that her mom works, and asks the new owners, which are Donald Choi's dad, if he will sponsor her for regionals. And then eventually, like after some negotiations, he does. They have like a big grand opening and Patty is there to...
I guess like be a spokesperson, essentially.
Yes. So Dixie crawls on top of the Wienermobile along with Patty, who's like celebrating the grand opening. They get into a fight. Patty knocks out her... Patty knocks out the veneers,
yeah.
Showing that she has like these weird shark teeth that... Is not
yeah like
just,
no way they make that joke about a non-Asian character like that.
Yeah. She bites Patty, giving her like a vampire looking like bite mark. Patty shoves her off of the truck and basically maybe paralyzes her, maybe kills her, who knows.
Yeah. Patty certainly thinks she's killed her.
Yes. Yeah.
This to me is one of the it's a I don't know if satire is quite the right word, but it's a play on a storyline that happens quite a lot on television and has never once happened in real life. You know, people finding themselves on top of a buzz, having
yeah,
a
just
fight.
Never get on top of a car, guys. Just
yeah,
don't.
Exactly. 16, you know, 17, maybe just turned 18-year-olds fighting on top of a bus. It just has never happened in real life. I swear I've seen it two or three times on television over my long life. And like, this to me is like, it's part of the satire on high school TV shows.
I mean, at this point, that's like the dominant mode for high school TV shows, right? Satirize the existing tropes. I feel like Insatiable's not doing that in a particularly original or skilled way for me.
But I see, now, if it wasn't so gonzo, I would see that. Because, yeah, that bit, nothing original. And we're at now the stage where I, other than what's going to happen with the Bobs and Coralie, I don't have a lot to be like enthusiastic about. The plot gets aggravating to me. But I think in the mode that we're in, but the fact that we've had like everything has been thrown at us, if you're still with it, absolutely, I'm here for it.
Mm-hmm. So Patty is the like victor of this vampire bitch fight, which is a great meme. I love it. And then Dixie comes back to school and everyone turns on Patty. And then Patty realizes she has to rehab her image. So she has a roast. And at that roast, everything falls apart. I want a roast for my birthday. I love it. And so while that's happening, we also get the Bobs fighting in the bathroom. And that's where to me the second half of the show lives Bob and Coralie.
I feel like there's no question that that is the most heartfelt and beautifully written part of the entire show for me.
It's kind of one of those three or four moments in the show that just shook me, and it was they're fighting in the bathroom over something that seems probably non-consequential, and we know that Bob Armstrong has a toupee. And so at one point when they're tussling, Bob Barnard rips the toupee off and you just see Bob Armstrong shatter. He's just become this like sad, distraught person who realizes that like all of his armor has been ripped off. And then instead of Barnard making fun of him, he just looks at him and says, "You're beautiful." And then they kiss.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And so then Bob Barnard, who has spent the entire show finding excuses to take his shirt off, which is another bit, a very funny bit throughout the show, especially for people who watch Covert Affairs and astonished at every time.
And Ugly Betty.
And wondered, how could they find another excuse for this character to take his shirt off? Well, in this show, they do it so frequently and with such joy that, like, that's how you do it. We learned that Bob Barnard has always been a bit gay for Bob Armstrong. Since they were 14. And has, again, like many of the characters, constructed another edifice for the sake of appearances and has never really, although he has had affairs, he's never adopted a gay lifestyle, doesn't consider himself gay, even though, or does he?
He does. Okay. He considers himself, and that's one of the like interesting points, I think, is Bob Armstrong and Bob Barnard have a discussion at one point where Armstrong's like, maybe I'm bi. And that's like, Bob Barnard says all the wrong things that all gay men tend to say, which is very frustrating about like, oh, well, bi's just like route to gay.
On the train to gayville.
Which is wrong. But they like talk about both actually finding women attractive and liking sleeping with women. And that's when Bob Barnard is like, oh, no, but I identify as gay emotionally. That's who I am. And so then Bob and Bob have to reckon with like what this means to their life. Bob Armstrong really wants, he still loves his wife, Coralie. Mm-hmm. And we've been shown over and over that like he is actually attracted to her as well. Yeah. Like their first scene that we see of them together in the whole show, they have sex in the kitchen. And then they're like, there's a joke made by his son about like, you still have something on your pants.
Right.
It's clear that they love each other and that they're into each other. And so Bob has to like figure out, okay, there's this thing that I've been wanting that's more than just my wife, but also I love my wife.
Yeah.
And so that whole next episode is then him reckoning with how do I have it both ways?
Yeah. And there is essentially a threesome scene, which is actually not graphic in any way. They kiss.
It's really romantic,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's very romantic.
I was actually just watching it right before we came in here.
Yeah. And it's a really beautiful, like, finally, after a show that's been all about people just doing things for the sake of appearances, not doing the thing they need to do to actualize, three of the people do something to actualize. They get in touch with what they really want, what they really need, and it seems amazing. It seems very caring, very, very good for everyone involved. And it is like one of the rare, like unqualified, as you say, romantic and kind of beautiful moments of the whole show. And it's like, yeah, do this, guys, do this, do more of this, do more nice things that you really want, not what you think the junior league wants mm-hmm. to see.
Yeah. So after they have their like threesome night together or day together, I guess, actually, and they have had a great time, Bob Armstrong thinks, oh, this is resolved. Like this is what we will be. We'll be a throuple. And neither of the other two want that. And he has to come to terms with the fact that this is like what he might need, but neither of the people that he wants to have it with need that or can accommodate that.
Right. Or can be open about that. And it's hard for me to tell if it is, again, one of these like community wouldn't support this or whether internally they simply can't make it work. That's not clear to me.
I feel like just to me, at least, it is not one of those appearance moments because Coralie says to Bob, you're all that I need. Like, I don't need Bob Barnard. I just need you. And that's not all that Bob Armstrong needs. Mm-hmm. And so,
right. He's a polyamorous person trying to be in a relationship with two monogamous people.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's just thrilling to have a TV show where polyamory is explored by adults mm-hmm. in a casual way that is not like weirdly voyeuristic or judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
It's just presenting it as a possibility.
Mm-hmm. An option that might be right for some people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so at the end of the season, Bob is then basically forced with an ultimatum from both of them of you have to choose. Do you want to stay with Coralie or do you want to go with Bob Barnard? And that's kind of where we end Bob's storyline.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale. Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Bob told me I had to face my truth, and now it was all too clear. I was selfish, destructive, and so caught up in my own self-righteous anger that I didn't think about how my actions would affect anyone else. Bob was right. I was ugly on the inside, so it didn't matter what my outsides looked like. Not anymore. So who cared what I ate? I just didn't want to feel this pain. I didn't want to feel anything at all. So I turned to the only friend I had left. Happy birthday, Fatty Patty.
So I cannot bear to go into too much detail of what happens to Patty.
Oh my God.
At her 18th birthday, which is the roast, essentially, Patty manages to either, depending on your point of view...
She feels abandoned.
She feels abandoned and she is abandoned and maybe she causes it. And maybe the fact that it's her 18th birthday should have gotten her some slack. But anyway, her mother leaves, Nonnie leaves, Bob leaves. And in her anger, she lashes out and she tells the world of this town, which is the only world that matters to anybody in this town, that Bob and Bob are gay and that they're involved together. And she kind of hates herself for doing it on some level, but she does end up completely abandoned, completely alone. And she has hurt or has been hurt by just about everybody in her life.
Yeah.
So at the end of the roast, Patty is totally alienated. Bob, who's the most important person in her life at this time, she's ruined his life. He tells her that he was wrong about her, that he thought that because she was beautiful on the outside, she was beautiful on the inside too, but she's not. And so in this fit of self-loathing and despair, she goes and she eats the entire sheet cake that was brought for her birthday. And it's an unbroken take. And you can see her eating, and then as it fades to black, you just hear her eating and sort of gently sobbing. And
over the entire credits.
Over the entire credits, yeah.
Yeah, I like press play to keep watching them, and it was rough.
So for me, this is the big place where you see what I was talking about a little at the top of the show, which is that the worst case scenario for the show is not Patty never fills this hole inside of her, but Patty gets fat again. Because in the next episode, immediately what you see is Patty deciding that she's going to get back on the pageant track.
Well, because she's gained like 10 pounds.
Yeah, she's gained 10 pounds. So she reconnects with the figures who are consistently linked to the idea of like the healthy, good Patty, who are Coralie and Brick. And they're like, okay, we're gonna help you lose this weight. You're gonna use all of these like wrestling crash diet techniques. You're gonna do like really unhealthy compulsive stuff, and then you'll be fixed. And that's sort of like, okay, you guys, don't worry. She's still gonna look like Debbie Ryan. She's not gonna go back into the fat suit. That would be the worst possible outcome here, and it's not gonna happen. For me, that's where you really see the value structures of the show in place.
I think that's
a very good point.
Yeah, and certainly that fear of. It's hard to know what would be the worst case scenario. I mean, the one that you just sketched out is definitely something that they are toying with, that they constantly suggest could happen. And I don't know that they don't really go into whether that would be a good thing or a bad thing, because I think there's an assumption that the audience would know, like, that would be a bad thing for Patty, just because in many ways it would just mean that she had made no progress. To me, though, it in a sense shows, you know, just reminds us that for me, the biggest problem with the show is that they presented it as a revenge play. And she does say it sometimes. It's not just that's what Netflix put on the description of the show. She, you know, explicitly says, I want my revenge. But what, for me, that scene at the end of that episode really reminded us of how desperate she is, and how sad she is, and how alone she is, and how much pain she's in.
Yeah, and she's a kid.
Like, yeah, exactly.
She's just turned 18. I think, to me, like, why that scene is so haunting is because two teens, everything is the biggest deal, and everything is the end of the world. And so you have to, like, when you feel abandoned and lost, you retreat to the comfort of food or the comfort of a drug or the comfort of something that will pull you outside of yourself. And I think that it highlights like the desperation that you can feel sometimes as a teen who feels lost and alone is like, oh, I need to go back to this comfort, and this comfort for me is food. And the scene is not a true portrayal of like what binge eating is like. But I think because it is so heightened, as you're like just hearing her like breathing heavily and crying as she's just shoving her mouth with food, is that you're forced to like reckon with the times when you've done that. Or at least that's what I'd.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because, I mean, this is where I get caught up on the unevenness of tone, because if none of it has mattered, and if it's all like, oh, it's in a fanciful world, it's heightened, it's not, you know, you can't treat it with reality. To be brought to reality kind of pulls everything into question, because it does feel quite real to me. It's certainly not played for laughs in any way. That's where the trouble is. Like, if nothing matters, if we don't take things seriously, what happens when something that we should take seriously comes up?
It does sort of start to feel like they're punishing the audience for reacting in the way the audience was pushed to react, right? Because if this matters and if this is sad, then every other time that you laugh at something similar is suddenly like a transgression on your part, but you're just reacting the way the show wanted you to if you're laughing before this.
See, my stance on this is that, like, nothing matters at all, so that when those things that matter do, you are like shaken awake by it. It reminds me of this movie that I love that is about these two Brooklyn girls, and they're just insufferable and horrible, and you hate them, and you love watching them trying to get to the beach in a day, and it's just, ugh, you love watching how bad they are. And it's this movie called Fort Tilden. And then by the end of it, there's this one moment where you've hated them. They're like, they hate each other by the end of it. And they get to this beach, and all of a sudden, like, one line is said by these characters that they meet up with that then shifts everything into focus, so that you are kind of forced to like realize that, oh, everything I've been watching is not what I've been watching, even if it is. Everything is dual layered in that, like, I'm allowed to hate them, but then there are times when I am forced to be pulled inside of them, as if, oh, I'm seeing me on screen. I'm seeing the like horrible things that I could be pushed to do without even realizing it, because I've just been enjoying this raucous insanity.
Yeah. I mean, it's because I never laughed at Patty. Like, I just didn't ever you know, I didn't feel like the show wanted me to. So it's hard for me. It's not, to me, it's not a matter of like, oh, you know, that my response to her, like, to me, she's always been somebody who's struggling to reconcile who she is, to figure out who she is, to figure out, can she still be a good person? Is she the good person that she thinks she is? And this scene is just the real her. Like, ultimately, when it comes down to it, she doesn't have a coping mechanism, and so it's, you know, there's nothing funny, there's nothing, it's just desperation and sadness and loneliness. And in a way, I wish that had been the end of the season, because like the end of the season
that would have been really
is
great
bullshit. And you know, like,
but then Christian would still be alive.
Yes,
that's true.
You make a
that's
good point.
True.
You make a good point.
Yes.
But so I wish that, I mean, maybe, you know, I guess the chance of, I suppose, a little further back you put it, the weird, you know, the less likely it is that people will see it. But I don't know, like, to me, there's something that is the you know, the most stunning scene of the film, of the whole series, and kind of how you respond to it depends, you know, yeah, exactly. It depends on how you've been responding all the way through.
Mm-hmm. But we have the whole, like, the end of the roast. Then after the roast, Patty then has to reckon with, like, all the hurt that she has caused, but also all the hurt that she feels. She is then trying to figure out how to win regionals, because now Bob has abandoned her and apparently is now coaching Roxy. And so, like, who is her nemesis? So then Patty's like, you know what? I'm going to steal the Wiener Taco suit and go and kidnap Roxy. And then Roxy won't be able to compete and I will win because my biggest competition won't be there. So she kidnaps Roxy. But as she's kidnapping her, someone else comes and kidnaps her. And we're like, who could it be? The next episode starts. We're just like, I don't know. Who wanted to kidnap her? Turns out it was Stella Rose and Roxy who were kidnapping her because they wanted to fuck with Bob Armstrong and ruin his life because they both hate him for some unknown reason. Well, I mean, for reasons of like, you've ruined my life. I've loved you. What? How could you leave me like this? But like, also, what the hell's happening? So she gets kidnapped. She maybe murders Stella Rose to get away. And then like ends up back at the, she ends up at regionals, but then Christian calls her and is like, hey, meet me at this parking lot. So she goes to the parking lot. Christian's like, I've got Magnolia in the trunk of the car. So they open the trunk. Magnolia is there. Patty's like, oh my God, what the fuck is happening? Stop. We need to get her out of here. Goes and unties Magnolia. But Christian hands Patty a tire iron and is like, we have to kill her. She's seen us now. We have to kill her. And so Patty then lets Magnolia run away. And instead of running away with her or like getting in the car and driving away or doing anything, she just starts beating Christian to death, which, like,
best scene of the show.
Yes.
Like, no contest.
Full on bludgeoning.
That's like the one thing I think we can all agree on is like that was a great
scene. If only it could have happened in episode 3, maybe.
Yeah, like
when we first met Christian.
Yes.
First time he shows up, just break out the tire iron.
Right.
Because he's such
trash. There should
trash.
Be a tire iron, like any scene that Christian's in, there should just be a tire iron on the table.
Yes. And so she doesn't know what to do, so she calls Bob. She has somehow taken his body that she has beaten to a pulp on the ground, put it into the trunk of his car, has driven his car out to like near the reservoir or something, calls Bob to come get her. Bob shows up and is like, oh my God, this is awful. Has her change into her like dress for the competition because she is covered in blood. And they then take the car and shove it into the like reservoir or lake or whatever. And it just doesn't go in. And there's like half of the car is still there. And Bob just yells something like, I don't even know what he yells, but he just is so exasperated. And that is the end of the show. And at the end, we're like, what the fuck happened?
Really?
Is this good? Is this bad? Is this a plot? That's kind of the point. I want to know what happens next.
Constance, I'm curious. Do you recommend people watch this? Do you say, just give it a wide berth? What do you think?
I think that is a choice every man must make for himself. I think certainly it's reasonable to want to watch it on your own and make up your own mind about it. But if you're someone who maybe has issues around PTSD about how people talk about fat people, and you look at the trailer and the discourse around the show and you're like, I don't want to inflict that on myself, I think that's also a pretty reasonable choice. I know I've spoken to people who identify as fat and who have tried watching the show and just had to turn it off every few minutes because they were feeling really triggered by what was happening. So I think we've given plentiful material about it, and listeners should be encouraged to make up their own minds here.
That's interesting for me to hear, because in one way I felt, I mean, and I completely understand why, and like, we saw such a tiny, you know, she was called Fatty Patty. That's right? Fatty, not
yes,
Patty.
Yes, Fatty Patty.
She was called Fatty
yeah,
Patty.
Yeah, she says to herself at the happy birthday, Fatty Patty.
Yeah.
And then she digs in.
So we know that she was called that. We know that kids would, you know, one girl stole her donut. And so to me, like, I understand why you can't, but I almost wish it had been clearer how much pain this had caused her. Because I think, you know, you don't need anybody to say, kids, bullying's bad. And that we've seen so much bullying on television. Like, I almost, to me, there's a sense of like, it's not real enough. But again, I completely understand why you don't just keep showing it over and over. But to me, you do get the sense that she had an awful time without having to have it kind of put in your face too much that she went through this. I did enjoy it. As has been clear, there are things that I did not like. I don't care for supernatural shows, even Buffy. I'm just not into
gonna
it.
Gonna have to fight now.
I'm gonna have to unplug your mic. Danielle, we're starting this entire podcast over. It's just gonna be me and Constance. June is in no way authority on any of these issues.
So there are many things that I didn't like, but I loved the campiness of it. I loved the humor, and I loved the big play out with the thruple.
Yeah. I mean, if it's not clear from everything I've said in this podcast so far, I'm a blind stan. I love it. I'm getting a Debbie Ryan tattoo on my chest tomorrow. It's just a great show. I would urge everyone to try it, at least.
I almost want to tell them to start in episode 3, though, because the first episode is not
yes,
good.
I think starting in episode 2 or 3 is a good idea. I think with actually a lot of shows. Like, that's how I enjoyed Castle Absolutely. Rock on Hulu recently. But, like, I think you have to go in ready to have fun. Yeah. And if you're not going to have fun, just quit immediately because it's not going to be for you. And that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. If it's not obvious right from the start that this is going to be something you find sunny and funny, run away, because it's not going to change. It is what it is.
Exactly. But obviously, I had a great time. I enjoyed it. I guess my final question for everyone is, would you watch the next season?
I mean, if they paid me to.
June?
Yes, but if it was clear that it was going to be like a supernatural procedural, then I'm out.
I can't wait for a second season. I think it should come out tomorrow. I'm ready for it. I hope they do it. I think, at least from what I've seen online, a lot of people like it, even if critics don't like it. It has like an 80-something percent on Rotten Tomatoes from viewers. So
exact inverse.
Exactly. So I think I would definitely watch a second season. I'm ready for it. And I hope it happens. If it does, we'll have to have you both back to tear it apart and build it back together. Thanks for coming on, guys.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. Our producer is Danielle Hewitt. Thank you, Constance.
Thank you.
Thank you, June.
You're welcome.
And we'll talk to you next time.